time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
NATO, Madrid, Spain. Wall Street Journal reporting. The U.S. will make its biggest military expansion in Europe since the Cold War, including its first permanent troop presence in Poland, as NATO prepares for two more members, Sweden and Finland, to join the alliance in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, to comment on the NATO meeting in Madrid and the significance of a permanent troop presence and a permanent command center in Poland. Jeff, you're a veteran of NATO. This is a moment in time when something has happened that looks to be front line being manned against the Russian aggression, not only now, but also in the future. Do I read that correctly? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. I think you absolutely do read that correctly. I think what has occurred, and we need to keep this in mind, is not only has Mr. Putin destroyed the peace in Europe, Mr. Putin has destroyed the security architecture in Europe that was created in the aftermath of the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s. Such programs as Partnership for Peace, efforts by the OSCE, various arms control agreements, et cetera. And now we are cobbling together a whole new security architecture to meet what is clearly a Russian threat. The thoughts, which were pretty common back in the early 1990s, that we would view Russia as a potential partner. And even at times, there were whimsical discussions, I think, about Russia actually joining NATO. That now has all been destroyed and washed away by the ongoing hostilities. And so a permanent presence by the United States in Eastern Europe just underscores that we are back to viewing Russia as a threat. We must put together forces that can deter and defend NATO partner countries, particularly those that are frontline states having borders with the Russian Federation.
The objection that Turkey mentioned these last weeks was lifted, and Sweden and Finland will now join. What does that mean for the commitment that NATO's making to the front line, Jeff?
It means that the commitment is expanded while at the same time the commitment is bolstered. It's expanded because now the frontline border of NATO just was extended by 800 miles. And that is the distance that Finland enjoys a border with the Russian Federation. It further bolsters the alliance because obviously these two additional countries, Sweden and Finland, have fairly significant military capabilities in their own right. But it also means, I think, significantly geographically, that the Baltic Sea, which is critical to Russian naval activities, if they're going to flush their fleet, which is located in St. Petersburg and Kaliningrad Oblast, it's going to be much more difficult for them to consider doing that, as effectively you've made the Baltic Sea into a NATO lake, as it's surrounded almost totally by NATO members now with the admission of Finland and Sweden.
The list of commitments to NATO is long, so I'm just going to touch on some of these things. This is the U.S. sending a brigade combat team of 3,000 troops and 22,000 enablers in Europe to better coordinate training and exercises from Romania. We also have more armored aviation air defense and special operations forces on the way. Two more U.S. destroyers stationed in Spain at Rota. Two squadrons of F-35 aircraft stationed in the U.K. And an unspecified number of, quote, additional air defense and other enablers are headed to Germany and Italy. This looks like a beginning escalation, Jeff, not an end. We're We're looking at a map that is growing in scale. This is not the 21st century as it began. This begins to be reminiscent of the 20th century after the Berlin crisis.
No, that's exactly right. And you pointed early on, John, to the decision to now put a permanent U.S. presence in Poland and put a major army headquarters in Poland. And that's of significance because that particular headquarters then can coordinate various other units that might be assigned to it, either U.S. forces or NATO forces, in any type of military operation that might occur in the region. So that's very significant that you've got that coordinating command and control headquarters with a lot of the implementation units that are associated with that, signal, intel, et cetera, right there ready to go in Europe. That also will be forward deployed in Poland, further underscoring that desire to deter Russian aggression, defend those frontline states from attack if that should occur, but also reassure them about the United States and NATO members' willingness to defend them should that occur. The bedrock of NATO, we have to remind ourselves of this, is NATO is a collective defense alliance. This is all about defending the territory of alliance members. The Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all, is the cornerstone of this relationship. So there will be also, I think, some internal friction that's ongoing where certain countries have committed, Germany's a good example, that they will forward deploy forces to places like Lithuania, but they'll only put a small portion of that force forward but have the balance prepared to be deployed rapidly as required. While operationally that sounds very efficient and also may facilitate training, what it also means then is in a crisis, a political decision has to be made by authorities to deploy that unit forward, which obviously then is escalatory in crisis and is less reassuring to frontline states, particularly the Baltics, who don't have much geographic depth, that this will enhance deterrence as well as defense should Russia decide to be aggressive.
Jeff, we're back to the Suwalki Gap. This is history now. The Suwalki Gap is the piece of territory, Poland, Lithuania, on either sides of the border between Belarus and Kaliningrad, which momentarily has been cut off from the land bridge from Belarus to Kaliningrad, the exclave controlled by the Russian forces. They can resupply by sea, but not by land. So is it time for me to get out my Cold War maps, Jeff? Is that that's what we're going to start training in East Germany now for the Armageddon Day?
It may well be necessary, John. You know, it's funny. We used to laugh during the Cold War at the end that we had planned to fight more battles in the Fulda Gap that never happened than you can possibly imagine. And we had studied that particular relatively small piece of territory endlessly for about 30 or 40 years. And it looks like we're going to do the same with the Suwalki Gap, which most military planners could not have identified if their life had depended on it even a couple of years ago. But it'll be those kind of things that we're looking back at for the future if we're going to make sure operationally we could be effective in defending those particular NATO partners if they were attacked. To some degree, I think the Lithuanians have expected this kind of threat from the Russians. There's been this ongoing agreement between them and the Russians, allowing transit by rail of supplies coming in. So far, at least, they seem to be implementing only the EU sanctions against Russians in terms of what material is not allowed to be transited. But the Russians have raised this to a level of a crisis. And we have seen even evidence, John, of what I would call horizontal escalation, where Russian hackers over the last few days have been making a pretty significant assault against Lithuanian cyberspace. In response, and they're very clear about this, in response for the restrictions Lithuania has placed on transit across its territory between Russia and Kaliningrad.
The Lithuanian border with Belarus, the Polish border with Belarus, to my understanding, as late as the summer of 21, the Lithuanian border with Belarus was not militarized. There was hardly a fence. That's why Belarus was blamed for pushing immigrants that they flew in to Minsk and pushed into Lithuania. You could just walk across a field. We're now looking at militarizing the whole of the frontier, Jeff. Is that correct? We're putting in watchtowers. We're putting in checkpoints. And Poland will be first on the frontier to prevent transit from one country to another. It's strange territory, Jeff. It's very strange. We've transformed everything within, 6 months? That's all it's taken.
You know, Vladimir Lenin once said, Sometimes decades go by and nothing happens. And then weeks go by and decades happen. And I think about that saying frequently when I consider what's happened since the 24th of February. And you're exactly right. So some of that putting in defensive structures along the border between Poland and Belarus had begun because, as you rightfully point out, John, that refugee crisis, which occurred only a year or so ago, in which clearly the Russians in Belarus were weaponizing refugees to destabilize the territory of Poland and NATO more broadly. So that had begun, and now it's being expanded in earnest. It's also been interesting to me that over the period of this particular conflict since February, Belarus obviously has moved much closer to Mr. Putin and to Russia. Mr. Lukashenko is clearly a puppet of Mr. Putin and knows that he has to have Putin's support if he's to stay in power. This week, at the onset of the G7 conference and then subsequently the NATO conference, began with a widespread missile attack by Russia against various urban targets all across Ukraine. A significant portion of those missile strikes began either on Belarusian territory or from Russian aircraft flying over Belarusian territory. So it seems that the Russians are trying to push, pull, or drag Mr. Lukashenko into being an active protagonist in this particular war.
What I know about Belarus as of last summer, that is not a stable government. The Belarusian diaspora in America, I watched them demonstrate during the stolen election of 2020, the summer of 2020. There is nothing secure there, so that the Kremlin is making partners with a country that's fragile, that's brittle, hardly what I would describe as a country I would want to put on the front line against Poland, Jeff. Poland has wanted to fight since 1945 with Russia. We've held them back with NATO all these years since they got out of under the boot. Poland's ready to go, and they won't even take a drink of water by the time they run through Minsk.
This may be true, John, but I think the bigger concern, if you're President Lukashenko of Belarus, is the internal problem. At the onset of this conflict, there were reports of Belarusians, even in the military bureaucracy, providing intel to the Ukrainians of sabotage of Belarusian railway networks to prevent the Russians from effectively resupplying their forces from Belarus. So Mr. Lukashenko's dilemma is he knows he has to stay close to Mr. Putin to stay in power. But if he gets too close to Mr. Putin, he could actually tip the scale internally and see a massive domestic crisis, which might unseat him and his own population. I think it's unclear or uncertain to him if he was to order the Belarusian military to actively invade Ukraine, that they actually would follow his orders. But meanwhile, by trying to do that, I think Mr. Putin is trying to at least force the Ukrainians to some degree to divert some forces to at least keep an eye on their northern border with Belarus in case Mr. Lukashenko should decide he has to get involved in this war to maintain that relationship with Mr. Putin and maintain his position in power.
There is a cold war along the frontier, but Jeff and I are going to turn to a hot war, not now, at 1863. In 24 hours at 9 p.m. East Coast time, Colonel McCausland and myself will discuss the 3 days of the Battle of Gettysburg, 1863, day one, day two, day three. And the third day is remembered as Pickett's Charge, but there's much more to it. There's Lee's incomplete thinking about how to break the Union line. And Jeff, you've walked the fields many times. I note that Pickett's Charge gets all the attention because a mile and a half of open ground covered by two divisions that were cut up by the Union artillery. And you're an artilleryman, so you pay attention to it. But isn't it also true, Colonel, that the battle at Culp's Hill was critical? The other side of the line held against repeated attempts by the Confederates to break the Union line on that side at that moment. And Lee had done the thing that seems strange, and they argued about it for decades afterwards. And perhaps you're part of the argument, Jeff. He divided his forces on the final day.
That's exactly right, John. And what was supposed to happen was a coordinated attack where Richard Ewell on the northern end of the Confederate line would attack Culp's Hill at about the same time that Longstreet would do this massive attack at the center, preventing the Union from diverting forces from one area to another, because the Union Army enjoyed what we call in military terms interior lines, shorter distances which would allow them to redeploy forces more rapidly. But what happened that particular morning is the Union forces on Culp's Hill screwed up the plan by doing their own preemptive attack early in the morning hours to prevent that from occurring. And the day before, of course, there was desperate fighting on Culp's Hill as the Confederates tried to take it and came very close to doing so. And had they done so, Gettysburg would have been a two-day battle, a Confederate victory, and Pickett's charge never would occur. But, you know, it's also interesting, John, they call it Pickett's charge. The main reason it's called Pickett's charge is because he was from Virginia, and most of the journalists that were there from the South were from Virginia. In the official records of the war, of the rebellion, as it's called Longstreet's Assault on the Third Day, because there actually were three divisions involved, including people from North Carolina, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, as well as Pickett's Virginians. But, of course, it went down the newspapers as Pickett's charge, and that's how it's remembered.
And, Colonel, the coordination between the attack on Culp's Hill and the attack on Cemetery Ridge, that's a sophisticated attack. That would have been difficult in 1944, let alone 1863. Do I read that correctly? They didn't have lines of communication anywhere close to what you lived with.
Exactly. And it was done by a fashion whereby you would say, you know, as he was told to, you will begin your attack when you hear Longstreet's guns. Well, that's a pretty poor way to communicate and coordinate, number one. But number two, like I say, don't ever forget on any strategic plan, your opponent gets a vote. In this case, the Union voted at Culp's Hill to attack first and therefore prevented that from happening. The final point is, of course, all of this was further complicated for the South by the fact that Jeb Stuart and the primary Confederate cavalry was not available until late on the evening of the second day, which could have, if you will, better screened that particular attack, coordinated the attack, and facilitated the intelligence gathering. Stuart doesn't arrive until late on the evening of the second day, totally exhausted, and is, for all intents and purposes, pretty irrelevant.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, we'll leave 1863 till tomorrow night when we'll discuss the 3 days plus the Gettysburg Address from 9 to 10 East Coast time. I'm John Batchelor.
Me hicieron una reseña de que soy un camino difícil, rocoso y empinado. ¿Qué esperaban? La próxima vez les diré, no si manejas una Toyota Truck.
Sabemos de lo que estamos hechos. Toyota Trucks.
Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Love the night? Reach for Zin After Dark, a limited cocktail-inspired series for those who get up when the sun goes down. Try Zin's Mojito, Spiced Cider, and Espresso Martini nicotine pouches. Find them at select retailers, available while supplies last. Zin After Dark. Bring on the night. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.